Our men had been born on the river banks, and understood their boats and the moods of the Nile better than they did their own wives. Tanos and I arranged a system of horn signals between the ships and the shore party that functioned more smoothly even than I had hoped. On board the vessels, the sailors were also armed with poles to punt themselves forward and to fend off the bows. They sang the ancient river shanties as they worked, and the breath of Horus was the first to make the attempt. The sound of song and the cries of the horse handlers mingled with the muted thunder of the Nile waters as we hauled her forward, and she thrust her bows into the first shoot of smoothly racing waters. The green waters piled up against her bows, but their thrust was unable to overcome our determination and the strength of 2,000 men and 100 straining horses. We dragged the breath of Horus up the first rapid, and we cheered when she glided into the deep green pool at the head. But there were 6 miles still to go. We changed the men and horses and dragged her bows into the next tumbling, swirling stretch of broken water, in which the rocks stood like the heads of gigantic hippopotami, ready to rip out her frail timbers with fangs of granite. There were 6 miles of these hellish rapids to negotiate, with death and disaster swirling around every rock. But the ropes held, and the men and the horses plodded on and upwards in relays. My mistress walked along the bank beside the teams of sweating men. She looked as fresh and cool as a flower, even in the baking sunlight, and her laughter and banter gave them fresh purpose. She sang the working songs with them, and I joined with her in the chorus. We made up fresh words as we went along. The men laughed at the saucy couplets and hauled on the ropes with renewed strength. Prince Memnon rode on the back of Blade in the leading team of horses. Huey had tied a rope around the horse's chest behind the front legs to give him a handhold, because Memnon's legs were still too short to afford him a firm grip, and stuck out in an undignified angle on each side of Blade's broad back. The prince waved back proudly at his father on the poop deck of the galley. When at last we broke out into the deep, unruffled flow of the main river above the rapids, the working chant of the boatmen turned to a hymn of praise to Happy, who had seen us through. Once my mistress had gone back on board the galley, she called for the master mason. She ordered him to cut an obelisk from the granite massif that hemmed in the gorge. While we laboured to bring the rest of the fleet through the gorge, the masons worked with fire and chisel to lift a long, slender column of mottled stone from the mother lode. When they had freed it from the matrix, they chiselled the words that my mistress dictated to them, using the pharaonic hieroglyphics in which her name and that of the prince were enclosed in the royal cartouche. As we proceeded with the transit of the cataract, we became more expert with each pace we gained against the river. It had taken us a full day to bring the breath of Horus up the rapids. Within the following week we were making the transit in half that time, and we had 5 or 6 vessels in the gorge simultaneously. It was almost a royal procession, with one galley coming up behind the other, stem to stern. 10,000 men and nearly 1,000 horses were in the traces at any one time. There were over 100 vessels moored along the bank in the quiet, deep green reach of the Nile above the rapids, when the Hyksos fell upon us once more. King Salatus had been delayed by his sack and plunder of the city of Elephantine, and he had not realized immediately that we had continued on upriver with the great bulk of Pharaoh's treasure in the holds of our galleys. Everything that he knew about the river, all that his spies and Lord Intef had been able to tell him, had convinced him that the cataracts were a barrier that could not be navigated. He had wasted all that time in the city of Elephantine before setting after us again. He had ransacked the city and the palace on the island. He had paid informers and tortured captives in an attempt to learn what had become of the treasure and the prince. The citizens of Elephantine had served their prince well. They had held out against the Hyksos in order to give our flotilla a chance to complete the transit. Of course it could not last indefinitely, and at last some poor soul broke under the torture of the tyrant. King Salatus harnessed up his horses yet again and came storming after us into the gorge of the cataract. However, Tanos was well prepared to meet him. Under his command, Kratas and Remren and Astes had made their dispositions with care. Every single man who could be spared from the work of hauling the ships through the gorge was sent back to help defend it. The terrain was our greatest ally. The gorge was steep and rocky. The path along the bank was narrow and twisted, with the broken ground crowding down upon it. At every turn of the river, there rose high bluffs and cave-riddled cliffs, each of them a natural fortress for us to exploit. In the confines of the gorge, the chariots were unable to manoeuvre. They were unable to leave the river and make a detour around the gorge through the open desert. There was neither water nor fodder for their horses out there in the sandy wastes, and the going was soft and treacherous. Their heavy chariots would have bogged down and been lost in the trackless desert before they could reach the river again. There was no alternative for them. They were forced to come at us in single file along the narrow river bank. On the other hand, Kratos had been given ample grace in which to improve the natural defences of the ground by building stone walls in the most readily defensible places. He positioned his archers in the cliffs above these obstacles and set up man-made rock slides on the high ground overlooking the pathway. As the Hyksos vanguard came up the gorge, they were met with a downpour of arrows from stone-walled redoubts on the high ground above them. Then, when they dismounted from their chariots and went forward to clear the stone barriers that had been placed across the track, Kratos yelled the order and the wedges were knocked from under the rock slides, balanced on the lip of the precipice. The landslides came tumbling and rolling down upon the Hyksos, sweeping men and horses and chariots off the bank into the surging green waters of the Nile. Standing on the top of the cliff with Kratos, I watched their heads go bobbing and spinning through the cascades, and I heard their faint and desperate cries echoing from the cliffs before the weight of their armour pulled them below the surface and the river overwhelmed them. But King Salatus was tenacious. He sent still more of his legions forward to clear the pathway, and others to climb up the cliffs and dislodge our troops from the heights. The Hyksos losses in men and horses were frightful, while we were almost unscathed. When they laboured up the cliffs in their heavy bronze armour, we rained our arrows down upon them. Then, before they could reach our positions, Kratos ordered our men to fall back to the next prepared strong point. There could be only one outcome to this one-sided encounter. Before he had fought his way halfway up the gorge, King Salatus was forced to abandon the pursuit. Tanos and my mistress were with us on the cliff tops when the Hyksos began their retreat back down the gorge. They left the path strewn with the wreckage of their chariots and cluttered with abandoned equipment and the detritus of their defeat. "Sound the trumpets," Tanos gave the order, and the gorge echoed to the mocking fanfare that he sent after the retreating Hyksos legions. The last chariot in that sorry cavalcade was the gilded and embossed vehicle of the king himself. Even from our perch on top of the precipice, we could recognize the tall and savage figure of Salatus, with his high bronze helmet and his black beard flowing back over his shoulders. He raised his bow, that he held in his right hand, and shook it at us. His face was contorted with frustration and rage. We watched him out of sight. Then Tanos sent our scouts after them to follow them back to Elephantine, in case this was a ruse, a false withdrawal. In my heart, I knew that Salatus would not come after us again. Happy had filled her promise and offered us her protection once more. Then we turned and followed the pathway made by the wild goats along the precipice, back to where the flotilla was moored. The masons had finished work on the obelisk. It was a shaft of solid granite three times the height of a man. I had marked out the proportions and the shape of it upon the mother rock before the masons had made their first cut. Because of this, the lines of the monument were so elegant and pleasing that it appeared to be much taller once it was set on the summit of the bluff above the last wild stretch of the cataract overlooking the scene of our triumph. All our people gathered below it as Queen Lostris dedicated the stone to the goddess of the river. She read aloud the inscription that the masons had engraved upon the polished stone. "I, Queen Lostris, regent of Egypt and widow of Pharaoh Mamosa, the eighth of that name, mother of the crown prince Memnon, who shall rule the two kingdoms after me, have ordained the raising of this monument. This is the mark and covenant of my vow to the people of this very Egypt, that I shall return to them from the wilderness whence I have been driven by the barbarian. This stone was placed here in the first year of my rule, the 900th year after the building of the Great Pyramid of Pharaoh Cheops. Let this stone stand immovable as the pyramid until I make good my promise to return." Then, in sight of all the people, she placed the gold of valour upon the shoulders of Tanus and Kratos and Remren and Astes, all those heroes who had made possible the transit of the cataract. Then, last of all, she called me to her, and as I knelt at her feet, she whispered, so I alone might hear, "How could I forget you, my dear and faithful Taita? We could never have come this far without your help." She touched my cheek lightly, and I know how dearly you love these pretty baubles. And she placed around my neck the heavy gold of praise. I weighed it later at 30 deben, 5 deben heavier than the chain that Pharaoh had bestowed upon me. On the way back down the side of the gorge, I walked beside my mistress to hold the sunshade of ostrich feathers over her head, and she smiled at me more than once. Each smile was more precious to me than the heavy chain upon my shoulders. The following morning we went back on board the Breath of Horus, and turned our bows once more towards the south. The long voyage had begun. We found that the river had changed its mien and character. It was no longer the broad and serene presence that had comforted and sustained us all our lives. This was a sterner, wilder being. There was little gentleness and compassion in its spirit. It was narrower and deeper. The land on each side of it was steeper and more rugged, and the gorges and nullahs were crudely gouged from the harsh earth. The brooding and darkling cliffs frowned down upon us with furrowed brows. In some places the bottom lands along the banks narrowed down so that the horses and cattle and sheep had to pass in single file along the crude track that the wild goats had trodden between the cliffs and the water. In other places the track disappeared completely, as the bluffs and the cliffs pushed boldly into the flood of the Nile. Then there was no way forward for our herds. Hughie was forced to drive them into the river and swim them across the green expanse of water to the far bank, where the cliffs had retreated and left the way open for them to pass. As the weeks wore on, we saw little sign of any human presence. Once our scouts found the worm-eaten hull of a crude dugout canoe washed up on a sandbank, and upon the bottom land an abandoned cluster of huts. The sagging roofs were thatched with reeds and the sides were open. There were the remains of fish-smoking racks and the ashes of the fires, but that was all. Not a shard of pottery or a bead to hint at who these people might be. We were anxious to make our first contact with the tribes of Cush, for we needed slaves. Our entire civilization was based on the keeping of slaves, and we had been able to bring very few of them with us from Egypt. Tanus sent his scouts far ahead of the fleet, so that we might have good warning of the first human habitations in ample time to organize our slave catchers. I found no irony in the fact that I, a slave myself, spent so much of my time and thought in planning the taking of other slaves.